Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, July 26th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening today. We begin today with the abrupt announcement from President Trump that he's banning transgender people from serving in the United States Armed Forces. The president said on Twitter, quote, "After consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military." Now, this news comes just over 1 year after the Obama administration lifted the ban on transgender Americans in the military. The Pentagon put out a statement saying all questions regarding the abrupt policy change should be referred to the White House. President Trump, when he was a candidate running for president, said that he would stand up for the LGBT community, their rights, and their freedoms. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from two Americans, one Army veteran and one active duty, on how they're reacting to the newly announced plan. But first, Dan LaMoth is a national security reporter for The Washington Post. He's covered the military's transgender policy for several years, and he joins me now to discuss the president's announcement. Dan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Dan, the president announced the new ban on transgender soldiers on Twitter. It was rather abrupt. It seems to have taken the Pentagon by surprise because of this statement referring all questions to the White House. Do you have a sense or any information that the Pentagon knew this was coming?
I really don't at this point. There has been, I believe, a CNN report that suggested Secretary Mattis was at least consulted. With that said, we were told on Monday that he's on personal travel this week, essentially taking his first vacation since taking office in January.
Is that an unusual situation then for the commander-in-chief to announce a major change to military policy in this way, abruptly like this?
Yes, it's absolutely unusual. The medium's obviously unusual as well. I mean, this is really the first time any president has used Twitter in this way. But the other unusual nature of this is the military over the course of several decades has become more and more inclusive, and there is often vigorous debate over who to allow to serve. But once they make a decision to let some kind of people in, they've never gone back on that. You know, there used to be segregation with black soldiers. There used to be don't ask, don't tell. I mean, all of these things over time have kind of been rolled back. This would be a reversal that would actually make it more strict than it was last year.
A reversal, incidentally, that comes on the 69th anniversary of the desegregation of the U.S. military. Dan LaMoth, President Obama, toward the end of his term, announced the new policy of allowing transgender people to openly serve. That was a little over a year ago. What's been going on in the meanwhile in terms of a transition, in terms of the new policy? Has it been rolled out? Has it been implemented at all?
Yes, is the short answer. It has been. But there are several pieces to it. The decision was made a year ago in June. The initial piece of it was, if you're already transgender and serving, don't worry about it. But the other additional pieces, there were implementation plans where, you know, they were pushing out basically direction and guidance to commanding officers on what to do if, somebody comes forward in your unit, all those sorts of things. And then the last piece that was still sort of up in the air, they announced last year that transgender recruits would be allowed, but they would not be allowed until last month. And then last month, Secretary Mattis pushed that back to the end of 2017. So I was not necessarily surprised to see that they would push back or not allow transgender recruits. That seemed to still be up for discussion. The surprising part here is that, at least according to the president's tweets, it looks like all transgender service members, including those already serving, will no longer be allowed. So now the question becomes, are you going to be pushing people out of the military?
Dan LaMoth, you've also been speaking with Brad Carter. He was a former Obama administration official who helped usher in the transgender policy in the military that you're talking about. What has he said?
Brad Carson was a congressman from Oklahoma, Democrat. He eventually took a mid-level job in the Pentagon working on policy, personnel policy, including this. He was frustrated, I think, on a couple levels. One is that he pointed to there basically being very little precedent to restrict a kind of service member that already had been allowed to serve. He really thinks this opens up the Pentagon and the government to lawsuits and that this will ultimately be decided in the courts.
So as we go forward here, Dan Lamothe, there are lots of questions now for the Pentagon. They're referring them to the White House. You've been covering this issue for years. What are your critical questions now for whoever can answer them on who can serve in the military branches?
I think the first question is, what do you do with the hundreds of transgender service members who have come out to their units, to their commanders over the last year, now potentially putting their own military careers in jeopardy? The second piece is, there are, according to the Pentagon's own studies, several thousand transgender troops, many of which, you know, people probably don't even realize already serving. So what becomes of those people? Do they have to keep it to themselves? Does this become sort of a don't ask, don't tell light sort of policy? And then the additional question is, according to the president's tweets today, he said he's acting on the advice of his generals. I've heard lots of concern in the Pentagon from, you know, the Joint Chiefs and other people that are high up that want to know what the details are and want to know what their limitations are. But very few of them have been blanketly against it altogether, at least publicly. So this would seem to be a reversal of that. And it seems to put the Joint Chiefs in a difficult position where they're involved in both politics and policy. And that's a spot they're usually allergic to.
Dan Lamothe, national security reporter for The Washington Post. Dan, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We turn now to two people who've served in the military to get their reactions on the president's policy change on transgender people in the armed forces. Charles Clymer is a writer, a social equality advocate, and an Army veteran. Charles was with the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment for 3.5 years and was medically retired in 2012. Charles identifies as genderqueer. Also with me is Staff Sergeant Patricia King, who, after 16 years in the Army, became the first infantryman to reveal that she is transgender. Staff Sergeant King is active duty. She served in the Army for 18 years, and she said the news took her by surprise.
So I woke up this morning to my phone going off with concerned service members who just heard this news. So I actually woke up to this news, and I woke up to receive it kind of in a state of shock, not knowing exactly what this means, but knowing that I am eager to continue to serve.
Now, Patricia, you were the first infantryman in the Army to reveal that you are transgender. I mentioned that you have 18 years in the infantry where you still serve and 3 deployments in Afghanistan. I know that you're eager still to serve, but what do you think it might mean for you?
Well, if the statement that was released this morning is followed through with, then that means that transgender service could end as we know it in the United States. And that's concerning because we have so many service members who are transgender serving honorably right now.
Are you concerned that you might be kicked out of the Army?
Certainly, that's one of my fears.
What would that mean for you?
Well, I mean, I have had 18 years of honorable service at this point, and to find out that so close to the end of what's been a very proud career for me, that I could lose my job, that it would mean a fresh start. It would mean figuring out what's next, what the next phase of my life is. And for me, because I'm so close to retirement, I would have questions about whether or not I was going to retain that retirement, or I spent the last 18 years working towards a retirement only to lose it at the very end.
Charles Clymer, you're listening to Patricia King on her 18 years of service as a transgender infantryman. You have your own service 6 years in the Army. Your reaction?
First, I'm just honored to speak on this program with someone like Patricia. She has served her country with distinction. And the fact that we have politicians who never served sticking their noses in our units where they don't belong, telling us how that the military should be run is just, it's beyond decency. It's just completely un-American.
Charles, you describe yourself as genderqueer yourself. You have 6 years in the military. If this announcement had come during some other administration and you had faced the prospect of being kicked out, what does that mean?
Well, under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we had a lot of bisexual or gay and lesbian service members who were kicked out with absolutely no evidence that they had engaged in any sort of homosexual conduct. So even genderqueer folks are, I would say, under the gun right now in terms of looking at their career and the military deciding whether or not they're worthy to serve, which is completely ludicrous to me and to so many of us who have served with folks who fall on the spectrum.
So, Charles, you mentioned Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Of course, there was the change in policy under the Obama administration. Toward the end of the Obama administration, the order that transgender people would be allowed to serve, the Trump administration Secretary of Defense James Mattis delayed that decision. Now here we are 6 months into the Trump administration. From where you sit, Charles Clymer, what's going on here politically with the ability of LGBT people to serve?
We are watching a madman in office unilaterally making decisions without the military's input. I think James Mattis, I think that most of our senior military leadership, not to mention the hundreds of thousands of officers who overlook, you know, everyone in the military, they believe in one standard. And either you meet that standard or you don't. And whether you're gay or straight or transgender or cisgender, that has nothing to do with it. We're looking at not a man trying to cut down costs, but this is about fear and loathing of transgender Americans. That's all this is.
Staff Sergeant Patricia King, have you been willing to put your life on the line and die for this country?
Well, of course I've been willing to do my job. That's what raising your right hand and serving in the Army means.
Patricia King, the Pentagon has made gender reassignment a covered health benefit that was ordered by the Obama administration. What do your colleagues, your friends who are part of your transgender service nonprofit that you're part of, say about that benefit and the prospect of losing it?
Well, I think it's important to remember that both Rand Corp as well as the New England Journal of Medicine did independent studies on the cost. And aside from that, the DOD embarked on a one-year study to determine what the cost would be. And all three, as well as the 18 partner nations with Open Trans Service, have all determined that the cost is nominal and that it is worth the benefit of retaining the best and brightest service members in our military. So I have friends who are very concerned about the possibility of losing benefits. But more importantly, we're concerned about the possibility of losing our ability to serve our country. If I was told today that some of my medical benefits could fall to the wayside, but I would be able to continue to serve, I would certainly ask for the opportunity to continue to serve a country that I love.
Charles Clymer, Army veteran of 6 years, before we go, your final thoughts?
I just want to say to Patricia and every other transgender American serving openly right now, we got your backs. And we're just not going to let this happen without a fight.
Thank you.
Staff Sergeant Patricia King, your thoughts?
I just want you to know that no matter what, service members are going to continue to serve and do their job as long as they're in the military. And that is the same for transgender service members as anybody else. We will continue to serve honorably and with pride because that's why we enlisted in the military in the first place.
That is Staff Sergeant Patricia King, 18 years in the Army infantry, including 3 combat deployments to Afghanistan. And also Charles Clymer, specialist, 6 years in the United States Army. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're hearing your reaction to President Trump's new ban on transgender people serving in the military.
This is Lewis from Ohio. I think what Trump did is disgusting. Diversity is what makes America great. Any sex, race, or religion willing to put their life on the line for our country is a hero, not an outsider.
My name is Nasreen Ghazi, and I'm calling from Philadelphia. I just wanted to say that as a physician and as a Muslim woman, that I support our transgender brothers and sisters. And I think that the current president's decision is terrible.
Give us your take. 8778 My Take is the number. You can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. When it comes to Russia, the focus now has shifted to the president's aides, including former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort. Manafort refused to testify in public yesterday. So on Monday, the Senate Judiciary Committee issued a subpoena to compel him. Manafort's lawyers cut a deal, and now he'll testify in private at some later date. Paul Manafort, though, spent 5 months as Donald Trump's campaign manager and chairman in 2016. His exit from the campaign coincided with revelations of millions of dollars in undisclosed payments that Manafort received working for pro-Russian political causes in Ukraine. Chad Day is a reporter on the Washington investigative team for the Associated Press. Chad, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a little bit of news, because there's been a lot of it. Paul Manafort, as I mentioned, caught a subpoena from the Senate Judiciary Committee. He was going to be compelled to testify today. Now it appears he struck a deal to get out of it. What do we know?
So what we know about this is that last night, the Judiciary Committee rescinded a subpoena that they'd issued for him to appear today. He was going to testify during this public hearing. And what they did is they reached an agreement that he had agreed to turn over some documents to them that they had requested, and also to continue negotiating a possible private interview with the committee, much like he had yesterday with the Senate Intelligence Committee, in which he discussed a Trump Tower meeting from June 2016 that has been attracted a lot of attention because it was with a Russian lawyer who was, at the time, selling this meeting as part of a Russian government effort to aid the Trump campaign.
Right. So that meeting appears to be just one narrow window into a much broader set of investigative targets that the special counsel Robert Mueller and his team are looking at. Let's get into some of the broader story. Do we know specifically what Bob Mueller is looking at when it comes to Paul Manafort?
So we know a little bit about it so far. And, you know, details are still coming out as more and more reporting goes on, and also as the investigation continues. But what we do know is that there was a longstanding FBI investigation into kleptocracy in Ukraine. And this investigation was looking at the former president, Viktor Yanukovych, and his political party, the Party of Regions, which was the ruling party for quite a while. Now, Paul Manafort worked for Viktor Yanukovych as a political consultant for a long time, starting in the mid-2000s on up until 2014. And so we know that he's actually been one of the subjects that they've been interested in looking at as part of this investigation, because they're trying to track the money. You know, Paul Manafort hasn't been accused of any crimes or anything at this point, but what the investigators are looking for is to see, you know, if this money that they believe was siphoned off from the Ukrainian government coffers to kind of line the pockets of Party of Regions officials, whether any of that actually made it into Paul Manafort's pockets or his companies here, and whether he knew about that. Now, again, I should say that there's no evidence at this point that you know, he was involved in any kind of crimes, but we do know that they are looking very closely at him as part of that investigation.
Now, that money has also brought attention to real estate deals that Paul Manafort has been involved in.
That's correct. And so, you know, I'm going to bounce back and forth between some reporting that other people have done. The New York Times has done a really good job with this. Bloomberg has recently done a good job with this. But that's right. So anytime that you're trying to track money that you believe was coming from a foreign government, particularly these kleptocracy investigations, they're trying to trace money that most of the times is funneled through shell companies and then cleaned in some way. And so, you know, if you're looking at potential money laundering, you're always going to look at how that money may have been turned into property. Now, what we do know is that there's some federal investigations, particularly in New York right now, that have been looking into some property purchases that Mr. Manafort made, also some loans that are connected with those properties.
Now, Chad Day, in this complicated web, and it is starting to look like a complicated web, there's also the question of Cyprus, banks in Cyprus, how they're connected to this very money that you're describing, and whether Paul Manafort himself owed money to Russians when all of this was going on.
That's right. And so what we know is that federal investigators requested banking information, you know, related to Paul Manafort from Cyprus and Cypriot authorities. Cyprus is a well-known place for very wealthy Russians to set up shell companies, set up bank accounts. They do a lot of international banking through that island. And what they're looking for here is money that may have been routed through different types of shell companies or companies that were set up there, and then maybe through other companies that eventually would have went to Paul Manafort. What we do know is that recently there's been some paperwork that was filed in Cyprus that showed that Paul Manafort was in debt to some companies connected to some very wealthy Russians. In particular, one was a man named Oleg Deripaska, who is a very wealthy Russian who has been indicated in cables that were released by WikiLeaks as being very close to Vladimir Putin. Now, why this is important is that we know that Paul Manafort had worked with Deripaska during the mid-2000s. I mean, in particular, early on in that relationship, Paul Manafort had drafted a memo and pitched you know, Mr. Deripaska on this plan that he described, very elaborate political plan in some Eastern European countries that he described as a plan to greatly benefit the Putin government. There was a $10 million contract that was drafted and connected with this, although I should note we don't know how much of that work was ever carried out. What we do know that has come up in court filings is that, unrelatedly, Mr. Manafort did work for Mr. Deripaska that was private equity work, particularly related to the purchasing of this cable and telecoms company in Ukraine. As part of that, Deripaska filed a lawsuit or some court filings where he said that, you know, he had paid a lot of money to Paul Manafort, upwards of $19 million, and he didn't know where that money had went. And so the New York Times had recently reported that a portion of some of this indebtedness that is happening in Cyprus is related to money that is owed from Paul Manafort to Deripaska. Now, Manafort responded to the Times by saying, you know, these are old filings. And so we don't exactly know the status of that debt at this point. But what we do know is that, you know, Paul Manafort has had relationships with people and business relationships with them that were either wealthy Russians, people close to Putin, or Ukrainians who were also pro-Russian interests.
So, Chad Day, before we let you go, Robert Mueller's investigation continues. The investigations on Capitol Hill continue. What part of Paul Manafort's background or actions do you think worry him or his lawyers the most?
I think that right now, whenever you're under an active federal investigation like he is, as part of this kind of kleptocracy investigation, obviously that's going to be at the top of the list, I would say. But, you know, his past work is where there's been some other legal trouble. He recently had to retroactively file with the Justice Department as a foreign agent for parts of his Ukrainian work and reported about $17 million worth of political work that he did. A lot of it in Ukraine, but some of it bleeding over into Washington, where it kind of got him into trouble. I would say that Paul Manafort has said that all of his Ukrainian work was above board, that it was entirely appropriate. But I would say, you know, anytime that you have an active federal investigation, your lawyers are going to take that very seriously.
Chad Day, reporter on the Washington investigative team for the AP. Chad, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. All over the country, in hundreds of locations, the U.S. military and its contractors burn old explosives and munitions in open-air pits. Congress banned the practice more than three decades ago because of health risks, but exempted the Defense Department. And the pits continue to this day, where the military and its contractors burn everything from contaminated clothes and accelerants to raw explosives. ProPublica is out this week with a series of new reports detailing how the Defense Department handles environmental waste. Overall, they found that there are nearly 40,000 toxic sites on current or former Pentagon properties. Added up, they cover over 40 million acres in total, an area larger than the state of Florida. The cost to clean up all that pollution would be billions. Abram Lustgarten is a senior environmental reporter at ProPublica and the lead on this investigation. He joins me now. Abram, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Describe the extent of what you found in terms of how the Defense Department and its contractors burn and detonate hazardous waste across the country.
So for every single weapon or munition used or manufactured in the United States, there is a site where it is manufactured, a site where it's tested, and in many cases, a site where it's disposed of. And the primary method of disposal in the United States is still to burn these munitions, burn explosives in the open air. They burn them on pans with really zero emissions controls at all because they say that they're too volatile or too dangerous to handle.
What kinds of toxins are we talking about coming from those plumes, and what are the potential risks to people's health?
The contaminants, which can include benzene and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, they all pose significant health risks, many of them cancer risks. But the health effects haven't necessarily been quantified or even studied. And that was really the problem that we looked at in Radford, Virginia. There are complaints in the community. There's concerns about high rates of thyroid cancer and high rates of thyroid disease and other health problems. But no government entity has really undertaken a comprehensive study to examine whether the pollution is connected to the illness that is there. And so in Radford, Virginia, in many of these other communities, you have people who are increasingly anxious, increasingly concerned about their health, and very little being done to examine the cause.
And we're going to hear from that Radford, Virginia community in just a moment about their concerns about the burning. Why was the Defense Department given an exemption to the environmental regulations that would ordinarily put a stop to this kind of thing?
Yeah, so the EPA initially wrote into the Resource Conservation Recovery Act a section called Subpart X, and that's the exemption that we're talking about. And it was not exclusively for the Pentagon, but they're the primary beneficiary. And the original thinking in the early 1980s is that the explosives material themselves were just too difficult to handle in many of the other ways that hazardous waste was going to be handled under that that new law at the time.
And what does DOD say, not only about the prospect of better disposal, but about the idea that they may be polluting surrounding communities near their sites?
Well, they kind of seem to be trying to have it both ways. On one hand, they point out that the number of burn sites has dramatically decreased and that they are pursuing alternative technologies in many places. They have built incinerators. They're moving in that direction. And at the same time, the Army's chief environment officer tells me that the technologies aren't proven and that they're not sufficient to replace open burning. And until they are, that they won't completely replace open burning. And he didn't really explain exactly why, but we're able to look at a couple of internal reports that the Department of Defense had done at Radford and at a facility in Tennessee and see their evaluation of the alternative technologies. And in their own words, meant for internal distribution, the alternatives are quite viable. They're quite cost effective. What seems to be missing is the pressure from the federal government, namely the EPA, that would force them to use them, which is in Department of Defense universe, that's the justification for spending the money to do it.
40,000 toxic sites across the country run by the Pentagon or its contractors. Hundreds of those sites have open burning of toxic chemicals. Abram Lustgarten with ProPublica, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
As you just heard, a big part of ProPublica's investigation on military environmental waste focuses on the Radford Arsenal outside of Radford, Virginia. According to government records, the arsenal is the largest polluter in all of Virginia. In 2014 and 2015, the toxic release inventory reported more than 10 million pounds of toxic emissions from Radford. That included 8,400 pounds of lead and other toxic chemicals from the burn pit. The connection between that pollution and negative health outcomes remains unclear, but the arsenal's proximity to five schools in the area has caused outrage in that community. Devon Bledsoe founded the advocacy group Environmental Patriots of the New River Valley. She lives in nearby Blacksburg, Virginia, and she believes the arsenal should be held more accountable. Devon Bledsoe, welcome.
Thank you.
So the arsenal, as I mentioned, Devon, is located near five schools. Bellevue Elementary School is the closest. What's been the community's response to their knowledge that toxic chemicals do come from burn pits and waft over the community and over these schools?
It's really difficult for the community because they're, in many cases, employed at the facility, and their parents or grandparents may have worked there. So it's difficult to criticize the hand that feeds you. But I am aware of a teacher in Montgomery County who pulled her own daughter out of Bellevue Elementary School because she was concerned about the pollution that her daughter was being exposed to. And she told the Montgomery County School Board and the superintendent. So it's not a secret, but it's not something people like to talk about.
So what have officials said to you, Devon Bledsoe, either in the military or associated with the arsenal, or even your own town council or town officials when you've brought this pollution issue to them?
Well, the town council in Blacksburg is made up primarily of employees, professors of Virginia Tech, and they've been very reticent to discuss the issue openly with community members or those who might be considering sending their children to Virginia Tech. As a matter of fact, Gregory Nelson, who got his PhD from Virginia Tech, has been pleading with town officials to at least proffer a resolution saying that the expired permit is not acceptable, the fact that we don't know about the depleted uranium is not acceptable. But the town, as recently as yesterday, sent an email saying that they needed some more scientific proof that there really was an issue.
Has the military or any federal agency offered to study whether communities or schools in your area are at risk because of the pollution?
No. As a matter of fact, in 2008, the USA Today ran a series called The Smokestack Effect that showed that Bellevue Elementary was right at the top nationwide for cancer-causing chemicals. But no one, not the governor, not either of our senators, not our congressmen, not the Board of Supervisors, not the town council. No one in a position of power has seen fit to monitor the air quality or investigate this further.
So without these types of direct studies, Devon Bledsoe, it's impossible to know if they're directly connected to any health concerns. But I'll ask you if there have been complaints of health problems in the town that people think might be connected.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, when we on the Facebook page started talking about the thyroid cancer, which the SEER, the National Cancer Database, shows that the rate of thyroid cancer in the New River Valley is more than twice the national rate and by far and away the highest in the state of Virginia. So when we started making that public, people started coming out of the woodwork to say, well, yeah, I've got thyroid cancer, or yeah, I've got thyroid disease. But again, it seems as if there's an effort to keep people from connecting with each other to make that association and gain the kind of power and momentum that we need to put a stop to this toxic assault.
Devon Bledsoe of Environmental Patriots of the New River Valley in Southern Virginia. Devon, thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And last week, New York theatergoers got the chance to experience an intimate portrait of one family rocked by the civil war in Syria. The play While I Was Waiting had its North American premiere as part of the Lincoln Center Festival in New York. It's performed by six Syrian actors entirely in Arabic with English subtitles. The play is inspired by a true story. It follows a family grappling with the aftermath of the brutal beating of a 20-something man named Taim at a Damascus checkpoint. Taim is in a coma, and while his family and friends confront their grief and their guilt, Taim knows what's going on around him. He's watching everything unfold, and he's telling the audience his story. Takeaway producer Alexandra Boti spoke with Mohammed Al-Farai. He's the 27-year-old Syrian actor who plays Taim. They talked about coming to the U.S., what Mohammed hopes this play will mean to audiences, and why he always goes home to Damascus.
Ismi Taim. My name is Taim. Amri. في آخر العشرينات تقريبا. I am 27 years old. من ليلة الحادث بطلت عد. Since the night of the accident, I can't remember anything.
When Mohammed Al-Rifai first stepped on stage in the role of Taim, he was thousands of miles from his home in Damascus.
My first time was in Bruxelles, and it was really a strange feeling because in this play I am saying my opinion. My personal opinion as Muhammad, that I couldn't say it in Syria because it's dangerous. There is a line, you can't cross those lines. So the theater, at the first time, I forget that I am in Europe. I thought I am in Damascus. So when I finished the play, I felt, oh my God. The police will come and arrest us and it will be a big problem. And then, I'm in Bruxelles. I'm not in Damascus, so it's okay. Be calm, Muhammad. It's okay.
The play While I Was Waiting brought Muhammad and the other members of the all-Syrian cast to theaters across Europe, but they almost didn't get the chance to come to America. With President Trump's travel ban in place, obtaining visas at one point seemed impossible.
It was really complicated. I have applied twice. The first time I had to go to the American embassy in Beirut. I did the first interview. They didn't give me a specific answer. They were asking quick questions. They didn't let me complete my answer. It was something very strange, actually. They asked for my email and told me they would reply me soon. I have waited their reply for a month to find out I wasn't accepted. Then all of us felt like we're not able to come to New York and make this show.
At last, he got clearance, just days before he was set to leave, to travel to the U.S. to bring the character of Taim to a New York stage.
From this character, I have something like freedom, say everything, to describe everything. So it's really something different for me.
Mohammed feels connected to his onstage counterpart. He can relate to Taim's disappointment with an uprising that embraced violence. And he knows what it is to lose people he loves, just like Taim and his family, and how it reshuffles your priorities.
When the family lose Taim, they really don't care about the situation, don't care about politics. They just want to make Taim come back and complete our life.
Have you lost anyone?
Some of my friends, yes.
More than 400,000 people have died in the Syrian civil war. But Mohammed says he worries that to Americans, the Syrian lives affected and lost have become just numbers and statistics.
Most of people they see in the news, people fighting each other, people killing each other, and numbers of death people. It's not Syria at all. There is people want to live in Syria, want to love, want to communicate with each other. And also there's people want to make children, get married, as a normal people. So I think when the audience see this play, really I want them just to see Syrian people, normal Syrian people. We are not just the numbers. We are a human like you, like anyone in this world.
While I Was Waiting will continue to tour theaters globally. But when it's done, Mohammed plans to return home to Damascus.
It's my country, my family there, most of my friends there. And if I still can go to Syria, sure I will. But it's really risky. Every day, every time when I leave Syria, when I travel out of the country, I feel like it's my last time. Because no one knows what will happen. Maybe they will ask me to go to the military service. Maybe I will face security problem. So then I have to find another place to go to and live in. There is no guarantee for that. I love my city. I love my country.
At the end of the play, Taim delivers a monologue about his final moments in his beloved home city. For Mohammed, it's a scene that transports him from theater back to real life.
It's my last time in Damascus. I mean Taim, the character. The last time for him in Damascus. When I see this monologue, every single time, I feel like I will face this situation soon. Soon, I have to leave the country. So I will face this situation. So for that, I feel afraid. I am doing it during character of Taim, but I'm afraid to doing it in the real life, in my personal life. But I am sure of that. It's really soon because this war will not stop soon. It will take time. So for that, I'm sure soon I have to leave the country. And this moment in the play, at the end of the play of Taim, it's really touched me from inside.
Until that day comes, Mohammed says there are places to find joy. He plans to work on comedy when he gets back home and to try to grow the theater scene there. But in the meantime, in everyday scenes from the streets of Damascus, he sees reasons for hope.
When you look to the children, they laughing, they want to grow up, they want to make their own life. You can catch some hope.
Are you hopeful?
I must be hopeful to complete my life. If we lose hope, if I lose hope, I should end my life. So I must be off. I have to be like this.
For The Takeaway, I'm Alexandra Boti.
You can see photos and watch a clip of the play While I Was Waiting. It's all on our website at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. By Netflix, presenting The Incredible Jessica James, a new romantic comedy starring Jessica Williams and Chris O'Dowd. This Netflix original film starts streaming July 28th. And by the Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state committed to acting quickly and decisively on corporate interests. Learn more about how Arkansas works for businesses at ArkansasEDC.com.